Welcome to Preaching Podcasts. This is a podcast from the Stevenson School of Ministry in the Diocese of Central Pennsylvania, where the three of us, Professor Josh Davis and Althea Spencer Miller, take a look at the lectionary from diverse and unique, maybe better distinctive perspectives to help prepare church leaders, preachers, teachers, pundits, proclaimers for Sunday worship. I'm your host, Deirdre Good, and those are the two that are with me, and welcome to you two.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Yes.
Wonderful to be with you both on this glorious, I don't know where you are, if it's fall. I don't know about the Alabama experience of autumn, Josh. But up here it's leaf peeping time. Not that there are giant coaches rushing through the highlands and the forests and the mountains of Maine because of COVID, but the leaves are turning regardless of the human condition. And it's quite beautiful. We have sunlight and 70 degrees yet, so it's not really cold at all. Is it nice where you both are?
Yes, it is. It's a slightly cloudy, but right where I am, it's a nice day, bright, sunshiny, with a touch of clouds.
And what about your leaves on the grounds of Drew, Althea? Because you have several trees, don't you, on the campus of Drew?
Oh gosh, it's a forest. Yes,
it's a forest, exactly. That's right.
Yesterday, the season I was in didn't have too many leaves changing that I noticed. Acorns were dropping, and it was a question of dodge the acorn to get from parking to the building. But that was it. But I noticed on the highway that there were some leaves just beginning to change.
Oh, right. So in New Jersey, that's what it is. Yeah. And Josh, how is Alabama?
It is getting into autumn. It's a different region. The climate region is different, of course, from where both of you are. But but it's getting there, and it's always my favorite time of year.
Is it?
Not so hot.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure exactly why, but when it cools down and things start to get, it feels, like you're sitting, like the world is lit by candlelight or something for a brief period of time or something like that.
Lovely. Lovely. That does sound nice. Yeah. Good.
Yes, it does.
And also today is Desmond Tutu, Archbishop Desmond Tutu's birthday. He's 90 in South Africa. I was looking at some news items about him. He's, as I was saying to Althea, restricting public appearances because of his age, but he's still very much alive and well and functioning as a source of delight and humor and really a moral conscience to the world. And isn't it great when we can say something like, we live in the same time and place as that great person.
Yeah, right.
Yes, it is. And such a breath of fresh air in his integrity and consistency and growth and development over the years. More than a breath of fresh air. It's like a distinctive caliber.
Yeah.
We're surrounded by so many people.
Yep. I'm thinking especially of his contribution to our moral lives in the truth and reconciliation work of South Africa and its apartheid regime.
Yes.
I mean, that surely has been picked up in Ireland. I mean, across the Yugoslavia, the Slavic issues and so on. It's been picked up across the world as a great model of what he says in a book title, without truth, there is no forgiveness. Without truth, there is no progress.
Yes. Yes.
Right. I once saw him on some kind of documentary, and it involved Richard Branson. And he was like hanging out at Richard Branson's house or something. And he was being, playful and things like that. And I thought, what is going on here? And then he was in the pool with Richard Branson. And then and then all of a sudden he just looked at him. He said, why do you have so much money? and it made everything just work. I was just kind of wondering what to think about what was happening. It was something about elders or something Branson was trying to do with like elders and tried to bring Tutu into it. And I thought, is Tutu playing along with this? And then that had that moment, and it was like it was pretty great. Yeah. And he dropped it in the middle of just enjoying himself. It was very clear, like, moral judgment that was taking place, but it wasn't in a way that was like, it completely re-coordinate, like, flipped the coordinates on Brand. He didn't know. He had to justify himself, but he was not defensive. It was a really powerful thing to see in many ways. I think only a certain type of person could pull something like that off.
Agreed. There's a story about his Nobel Prize, which he was awarded when he was on sabbatical at General Seminary. And the story is, I'm pretty sure it's true, although I wasn't there then. The story is that they couldn't find him on the campus, on the close. And so they set off for a search in the neighborhood to find out where he was, because he was clearly somewhere nearby. And apparently he was found in the local bodega at the back on upended packing crates with the shop owner, whose name is Frankie, with the shop owner sitting there eating baked beans for lunch out of a can with the shop owner, Frankie, having a conversation about life. And so they came to say, "Hello, you won the Nobel Peace Prize."
Oh, man, what a great picture.
That story is also very New York, too, because Frankie has a story somewhere of like, so I was hanging out with Desmond Tutu eating baked beans when he received this announcement. And it's just the kind of thing that in New York that would happen. Like, you would go into the bodega and Frankie would drop this story on you.
Yes. And it's all true. Exactly. Yeah. I'm so glad that you knew him, Josh. It's wonderful. Because that has become not a bodega anymore. You know, it's the gentrification of Chelsea that's happened. So we need to preserve these memories.
Actually, I don't think I did know Frankie.
Oh, well, it sounded like you did.
I know, I was.
That's good.
I mean, I might have, but I don't know that I did.
Well, you not just might, you should have. We can recreate it. Yeah. Wonderful. Okay, so let's remember.
Write an apocryphal story here.
Yeah. It's based on some truth.
Some truth somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It fits with what we know of him. Fits with what we know of him.
Likely.
Great. All right. Moving along here. So the lectionary readings that we're going to be reflecting on and taking shards of, as we did last week, quite successfully, I think, although I'm not a good judge of this. Are following, and this I do want to think about with you together, following the readings from the book of Job in the track one, the first reading from Hebrew scripture, Job 38, 1-7, is a fantastic moment in the book of Job when God speaks up. The whole of 37 chapters before that have been driving slowly, furiously, relentlessly, in a continual way towards this moment when Job wants a response from God because he's been so deplorably treated by Satan at the beginning of the narrative. And here comes Yahweh, here comes God speaking up in Job 38. So, I mean, one way we could enter into a discussion of some of these lessons chosen for the Sunday closest to October the 19th, proper 24 year B, would be to say it's about, these readings are about, some of them anyway, are about revelation. And we can see that in the collect, Almighty and Everlasting God in Christ, you have revealed your glory among the nations. Of course, there's no Christological revelation in Job 38, although I suppose some people might read some Christology into it. I mean, Jung read into it that the problem for Job was that God was too masculine, but that's a whole other story. If we just take the theme of revelation, we can look at Job 38 in light of that. We can also look at Psalm 104, following track one, "Bless the Lord, O my soul, O my God, how excellent, O Lord my God, how excellent is your greatness. You are clothed with majesty and splendor. You wrap yourself with light as with a cloak." I mean, this is a revelation of God in a very specific mode as part of the manifestation of the entire cosmos, the entire universe. You lay the beams of your chambers in the waters above. You make the clouds your chariot. You ride on the wings of the wind. This is the revelation of God in the cosmology, not just nature, but in the heavens above as well. Track two follows Isaiah 53, the suffering servant passages. And that actually picks up a theme that comes up in the gospel reading. So if I could just switch to the gospel reading, it's not that I'm driving towards that, it's just that I want to pair or complement readings with each other. So the gospel reading is the central section of Mark. We've been in that for several weeks now. It's the point at which, for the third time, Jesus in Mark 10 is explaining that the Son of Man has to undergo suffering. And the response of the disciples to this threefold announcement in Mark 8, 9, and 10 is incomprehension and disbelief and refusal. Because here we get an example of the response, in this case, from James and John, pairs of disciples in the identified in the Gospels, the sons of Zebedee, come to Jesus and say, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. Well, what is it you want? And they say, we want to sit at your right and your left hand in your glory. So in other words, they haven't understood anything about the necessity of the suffering, dying, ignominious fate of the despised child of humanity or son of man. And so Jesus goes on to say, you don't know what you're asking. Are you able to experience this? And they say, yes, absolutely, we can. And Jesus then goes on to talk about the metaphor of the cup that I'll drink, with the baptism with which I am baptized. You will be baptized, but to sit at my right or left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared. So the reaction of the other disciples is to be angry with James and John. And Jesus calls them and repeats the teaching, but in a different form. Among the Gentiles, those amongst in the middle of whom you live, those who they recognize as their rulers, lord it over them. This is a great all one word, a verb in Greek. And the great ones are tyrants over them. But amongst you, whoever wishes to become great must be your doulos, your servant. And whoever wishes to be first must be slave of all, doulos of all. And here comes Mark 10:45, towards which the gospel is driving at this central point. The Son of Man, the child of humanity, came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So you could connect that in some way to the teaching of the suffering servant in Isaiah 53, 4 to 12, although I'm not sure this is front and center in Mark's mind. It may be in the minds of those who choose the lectionary. The epistle, Hebrews 5, 1 to 10, is something I haven't thought about a great deal, but it's about the way in which Christ, in the understanding of the 13 chapters of the Epistle to the Hebrews, is manifest as a high priest. And to Christ as high priest, God says, you are my son. Using language of Psalm 2, you are my son, today I have begotten you. And God also says in another place, you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. And in the role of priest, the section continues, Jesus offers up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to the one who is able to save him from death. It looks like this is an allusion to the Gethsemane account, but in the epistle to the Hebrews, so there must be a sort of common memory of a tradition that just before he died, Jesus prayed to be absolved, to be exempt from the death that he was looking at facing. And says Hebrews, Jesus was heard because of his reverent submission. Although a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. And having been made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him. So that would be my summary. What should we talk about? Just want to alert listeners to the fact that Althea was unfortunately called away. You know, the trouble with being in academia is that you have to respond to all sorts of things over which you don't have a great deal of control. But Josh and I are going to continue our discussion. Thank you, Josh. And I'm going to start because I have the floor. Josh can inject himself into the conversation in any way he wants. I want to start with a little interpretation, a little reading of Job 38, because this is a really significant moment in the book of Job. And I mentioned last week, because we've been following Job in track one, that I have been so enlightened by the book of Job, a new translation published very recently by Yale University Press by Professor Edward Greenstein. And I've been able to teach it and do a little Bible study on it in our church here. When God replies in Job 38, up speaks, says the translation of Ed Greenstein, up speaks Yahweh to Job from the windstorm. And he says, "Who is this who obscures good counsel using words without knowledge? Bind up your loins like a man. I will ask you, and you help me know. Where were you when I laid earth's foundations? Tell me, if you truly know wisdom, who set its dimensions? Do you know? Who stretched the measuring line? Into what were its foundations sunk? Who laid its cornerstone, molding the dirt into solid as the clods are stuck together? When the stars of daybreak sung out and the sons of Elohim cheered." And then the translation continues. But when we remember or reflect upon the fact that, as I said in the introduction, we've waited for 37 chapters with Job to get God to respond, and God responds in chapter 38, it would be tortuous for us to try and imagine the language that I just read in Ed Greenstein's translation of Job 38 to be in any way a response to the concerns of Job. So let's just say straight out that the person who, the entity who speaks in Job 38 is really disconnected from the whole narrative of the 37 prior chapters. It looks that he's, or she, or it, or God is in a completely different frame of reference to Job's concerns. And so we're in what it could be Carol Newsom, it could be Ed Greenstein. These are great commentators on Job that I've been reading. God is in a completely different hermeneutical space. So we can see that in the language of his response, God's response here is mockery, is at the best something like teaching. So what is it then that God wants to try and teach? This language of the book of Job is using images that provoke puzzle, that have different models, that simply present Job as completely insignificant to the creation of the earth by means of foundations, from the wisdom hidden, from the wisdom that has to do with the secure of foundations of creation, completely ignorant of any of these events that took place at the beginning. So if anybody thinks that this is a dialogue in any way, as was the case amongst Job and three friends in the previous 37 chapters, this is not a dialogue. It's a discourse that seems to remind Job that God's realities and God's universe and God's world are really separate, in a different order of things. That Job seems almost to have no response to God's world is completely different. I think that's a place that we can start, because Job is going to continue next week, and we're going to get Job's response to the discourses of the deity, which is in chapter 42. But right now, what we're getting is God's presentation of how creation was affected, and how, I didn't read the next section, in 38:8-11, how God hedged in the sea, as the sea is gushing out of the womb, how God gives the waters from the cloud like a garment, rain cloud as his swaddling cloths. This is the baby of the creation of the world, the child, and imposed upon the world my boundary. And I said, this far may you come, but no more. Here's where I fix the surge of your waves. Have you, says God, in effect, had anything? Did you know anything about this? Have you had anything to do with it? So the otherness of God is in full rampant display in this section of chapter 38. And if we want to talk about Revelation as a theme of these readings, this would be a place where Revelation is not in the language and not in the way that humanity is able to understand or comprehend, but really completely other, you know, just to use the language of Rudolf Otto here. Josh.
I think for the longest time, I thought that this, you know, this is about, this is a, it never occurred to me until just recently that God's response here is basically like a list of facts and that don't really have any direct relationship to the question that Job is wrestling with, which is not like, I mean, it's almost like, well, no, I didn't set the stars in their place, and I don't, and I'm not, I didn't establish the foundation for the weather, but I do suffer it. Why is it that way? Because it's a question of not what is, because it is the case that Job has suffered. The question is, and it's not even why. Job's question is not even really why, but ought I to have suffered, right? Like, and God's response here doesn't respond to that aspect of the question. It's basically to say, yes, there are a series of facts, and I'm the cause, or not necessarily direct cause, because I don't think the book of Job makes God the direct cause of what happens to Job, but actually the indirect cause, right? Like the fundamental, like, which is, I mean, theologically speaking, it's a very important point, because it's kind of an anti-idolatry point. Like God's response to Job is one that's like, you know, it's not like that of a God who could be placated or something like this. Like, they change the weather for me, I'll make a sacrifice for you. Okay, yeah, I'll change the weather, like that kind of thing. God's response is no, I'm the real deal. I'm not one of those gods that's like one god among many. I'm the reason why there's anything at all, which is a very different kind of claim and an important one. But it still doesn't address Job's point, which is like, this ought not to have happened. Like, it's a moral point. It's a moral objection. And it's difficult to know exactly how to process that. Does that make sense?
Totally. And I completely agree with you. And I'm even going to compound it further by saying it's pretty clear to me, following Professor Greenstein, that the imagery of the divine response portrays a fundamentally amoral world.
Right. Yeah, right.
You could see it. Interpretations of this passage, Josh, have been, oh, this is a demonstration of divine providence.
Right.
Not really. It might be implied at best, but somehow all of this creation takes place at the outer edges of the galaxy. So the spaces in which God operates are not in the center, but rather at the edges, on the remoter points, at the foundations of the earth, where the doors of the sea are, at the horizon of dawn, at the recesses of the sun, at the gate of death, the store places of hail, wind, rain. Do you see what I'm getting at?
This is
a providence that is demonstrated in its absence. When you listen to the torrent of questions that are thrown at Job or any interlocutor by God. Indeed, at one point in this chapter 38, who cleaves a downpour's channel and a path for the thunderstorm to rain down on land without people, on wilderness with no human in it? Do you see?
Right.
This is just, I'm off, you are somewhere, and God is off in a completely different world, amoral and not at all concerned with human beings.
Right, because to the degree that God does respond, it's like in relationship to like utility, right? Like why did this happen to me? Well, I made the rain happen, and rain is, you know, and the difference between this and say like what Jesus says about the rain falling on the just and the unjust is like it's a similar point or a recognition of a similar fact, but in Jesus' case, it's also like not a hair will fall from your head without your father knowing, no sparrow falls without, it's the opposite of appears in many ways. I mean, there's a very important point, I think, that God's response is making to Job, but it's almost like, this is almost like Spinoza's God or something like this, like I think the way that H. Richard Niebuhr put it, like attachment to the to both the slayer and the life giver, without to whom no questions can be addressed about why it is that anything happens. Like it's inscrutable what is happening.
And it's not responding to any legal claims.
Right. Right.
But it's trying to remove itself, yeah, from the discourse of legality. Yeah.
And it struck, I was just listening to someone talk about, his name is Matthew Lynch, who's written a book about violence in the Hebrew Bible and talking about different, it's not a theological text, it's like a survey of violence in its different forms. And one of the points that he makes is that there's a, like the cry, the outcry, there's different forms of violence. And one of the, in the Hebrew Bible, particularly in the Psalms, where like to slander someone, for example, is a form of violence in scripture. And when that happens, he says like the outcry on behalf of that is one that's to call for a response from someone that can adjudicate it, right? And set it right. So to be saved from that and things like this, but it's the God's response to the outcry, which is what happens in the Exodus, for example, right? The cry rises up. God responds to the cry that is provoked by the act of injustice, and in doing so, steps in to judge, to be a judge. And there's like some wordplay on Moses and because I don't remember exactly what the words were, But that act of violence actually extends to the natural world as well, like animals and things like this. And there's none of that here, which is really interesting. Like this is, it's almost like Job is crying out, right? And it's not like he's rebellious. He refuses to like curse God or any of those kinds of things. He simply has a question, and there's this fundamental human outcry against what is the experience of injustice. But God doesn't respond in that way here. So there's a tension between like what we see of the disclosure of God in, say, the Exodus or in the Psalms or any of those things, and a God who is sensitive to acts of violence that extend to what we even things that we would consider, which we wouldn't even categorize as violence, which I think is really interesting. Like your enemies whose tongues wag against you and things like this, which are things that are presented as that. Does that make sense?
Yes. Absolutely, absolutely. Something completely different in God's response to Job here. I mean, even so what our reading does is add to Job 38:1-7 verses 34-41, in which we get mention of, do you, says God to Job, do you hunt the prey for the lion? In other words, we're introduced to animals. You could say, well, animals are a bit more like Job's reality. Who knows where Job is, but surely every human being is not too far from animals. also created by God. But these animals have nothing to do with domestic animals. So, for example, chapter 39, 1 to 3, do you know the season that the wild goats give birth? In the previous one, do you hunt down the prey for lion? Do you hang out with deer or sheep on the hillsides? Right. 39, will the wild ox want to serve you? I mean, just the juxtaposition of those two things, of course the wild ox will not be remotely interested in paying attention to you to the extent. Then we get a long description of the horse. Oh, well, you think, hey, domesticated horse, you know, perhaps this is slowly bending in some direction that Job or anyone who's reading or listening to this might fathom. Do you give the horse its bravery? Do you clothe its neck with a mane? Do you make it noisy as locusts? It turns out this is not a domesticated horse at all. Yeah. The blare of his snorting is fright. He paws the ground with power, eager to ply his strength as he enters the fray. He scorns the fearsome, does not flinch. This is not a domestic horse. This is not a donkey. You know, So everything about this is as if there's a sort of connection offered and then it's whipped away.
Right. This is what's strange about it too, is that it, like, you would think that this should settle the question, but I think the point that I was gesturing towards is that there's this whole other side of scripture which in a sense protests against this explanation, or at least accepts the truth of the reply, but is not satisfied with it as a response, right? Like because there's this whole other aspect of the presentation of God as responding to acts of injustice and adjudicating them, like acting as a judge. And the whole purpose of law is to set these things right which have gone wrong, and not allowing there's a protest even against, like, a recognition that, well, maybe the lion does survive by feeding on the lamb, but the blood that spills on the ground, like, there's a problem there, right? Like, and that the scriptures are not satisfied with. Jesus uses the example of rain, but doesn't use the example of he doesn't say, well, we're all predators and prey, you know, or something like that, which is kind of what God's answer here seems to be. So,
yes. And Job does respond in chapter 40, 1 to 5, which is before the next week's reading. He says, lacking respect, how can I answer you? My hand I place over my mouth. I have spoken once and I will not repeat, twice and I will speak no more. You're right to say that there is an aspect of the presentation of God that needs response. And Job's response is to say, I will close my mouth and be quiet. So right. This prompts God to go up into a second discourse. But we should go on to that next week, because I think we want to leave something for next week when we get to discuss Job's final words in the book of Job.
One other point I'd like to make here too is that I think a lot of times when people talk about suffering, they make a distinction between, like, physical suffering, or not physical in the sense of the fact that violence, for example, happened between the lion and the lamb or something like that, and that's different than moral evil. There's a kind of natural evil in a sense that's evil, not for the lion, but for the lamb, right? Because the lamb suffers that violence. And this is a way, kind of traditional philosophical and theological theodicy would answer this question. But one of the ways in which Job is generative is that it doesn't really. I mean, that can be an acceptable explanation, but you get all of those answers here. From God, but the moral protest still remains on Job's end, which I think is really significant. And thinking about Job as a character, I don't know if it's the right word, but the nature, like the way that he suffers or what is going on there is interesting. He doesn't strike me as someone that's, I don't know, over, like, he seems to have even transcended his own suffering in a certain sense. He's not completely preoccupied with it. Like there's a way in which, like, the questions that he's asking demonstrate, like, a real, like, he's not just affronted, like, he's not like scandalized by the fact that he lost these things, in the sense of being preoccupied with them, I guess. That's not the nature of the questions that he's raising. It seems like that perspective is represented by the people that speak to him, which he rejects. There's different answers that are given there. Does that make sense? So there's a way in which the nature of the protest that he's raising is one that doesn't, I don't even know how to say this. It's, because there's a, like, if you lose someone that's dear to you, and I couldn't imagine what that would be like a child or a spouse or something like this, where the pain that you are suffering is a pain that's oriented toward, the loss, what it is like, the fact that you have lost something. And that's a very important part of grieving. But it seems like over the course of the text, Job moves from that to another set of questions, I suppose. He doesn't remain there. He raises another set of questions which have to do with why this is happening at all. And it's from that perspective, and it's the people around him who are remaining at that other level. And responding, and that's why their responses don't work, because they keep trying to resolve this more immediate question, which can't be resolved in those terms, and so when God finally does respond, whatever is happening, it's a response to where Job is, but it doesn't directly answer. It's almost like God is saying, like, yeah, I do all this stuff, and it's almost like God is attempting to justify something that God too is implicated with Job in overcoming or something. I don't even know if that makes any sense at all. Like, it's almost like God Job's question causes God to recognize something, or perhaps recognize something that God's working overtime to avoid admitting is true. Or something like that.
There is that coercive element. Yes, yeah. There is it is not a benevolence that we are seeing. It is not a providential series of discussions, absolutely. And that is a really important segue into the final lines of the book of Job and the way in which Job's answers in chapter 42, which will come up in next week's lecture, have been taken as a conclusion, but Ed Greenstein is going to propose a different reading of them. So if I can just have that as a teaser for next week.
That sounds great. Are we tracking with what Greenstein is saying? Yeah. I mean, I imagine
I'm tracking.
Yeah, yeah.
The lectionary is not tracking Greenstein, but it's tracking Job.
Right. The lectionary is presenting this as a pretty straightforward story, right? In many ways.
Yes. Yes.
The pairings of the readings and things.
Yeah. Yes. But Greenstein is going to take the most difficult interpretation of the ending of the book of Job in his response. So we'll leave that for next week. Maybe we can go on to Mark 10:45, because in some ways, since all the lectionary readings seem to conclude with gospel narratives, that's just the way it's all set up. The passage of Mark 10:45, "For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many," is the culmination of the choice of material from the gospel. And of course, it does conclude chapter 10 of Mark's gospel. So another reason by which we might focus on it is it's the one place where we can see in the gospel some kind of explanation and understanding of the result or the consequences of the death of Jesus in the gospel. The giving of the life of the Son of Man is as a ransom for many. So that would be a good, that's the reason towards which I want to focus our attention. What we see here is the connection of the Son of Man, as has been maintained in chapters 8, 9, and 10, with suffering, but not just that. There's an intensification of suffering because the Son of Man is giving his life. And the means by which the Son of Man gives his life are, of course, crucifixion in the historical narrative, but Mark understands it as a ransom for many. So the ransom is often used for securing freedom of prisoners of war, of slaves, of debtors. So slave ransom can sometimes take the form of one person substituting for another in servitude. But the use of ransom terminology has roots within a Jewish sphere. It's connected in Hebrew Bible, say in Exodus 21 or Numbers 35, with atonement in those contexts. And in some other Jewish texts somewhat later, like Philo in his description of the sacrifices of Abel and Cain, we see a righteous individual or a group functioning as a ransom for the foolishness or sins of the larger group. In 4 Maccabees, probably written in the first half of the first century CE, we find the sacrifice life or blood of a righteous individual as recompense for the sins of the nation. So we can see that there's a rich possibility for Mark's gospel to draw upon a means by which the readership or the listenership of Mark's gospel can understand the wider significance of the death of Jesus. The interesting feature, apart from the language of ransom, is the use of the word many. And we should just pause to connect it to Isaiah 52:13 to 53:12, in which the suffering servant, he bore the sin of many in 53:12, is probably connected to 53:6, the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. So that many and all can be said to be types of synonyms. It's the way it's been understood in Christian tradition is all. And this universalistic interpretation can probably be maintained in the history of interpretation, but it does seem to go slightly beyond the evidence. Many has an inclusive sense only in certain contexts. And I know that it does occur, that many occurs in Isaiah, 2nd Isaiah, and in other passages. And probably the many of Mark 10:45 are the way to understand this would be that the many are the elect community, not the whole of humanity. So in 10:31, just before it, before our gospel passages for today, we see the use of many, and many who are first will become last. Not all who are first will become last, but many who are first become last. So it's possible to see a connection between the suffering of Jesus and the redemption of many as a part of the reflection on the meaning of the crucifixion, which is taken up in different ways by Paul, the epistle writer, and will be understood differently by Luke, Acts, in another gospel, in another two-volume context. But Mark's one reference here to the understanding of crucifixion is the beginnings of the foray into an understanding of the significance of the death of Jesus as a means to ransom and to pay the price for something that is brought about by satanic presence. Let's just put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I was going to say was that, like, you would pay a ransom in this context. Well, in the way that it's framed, or like in the context of war, you pay it to the enemy to redeem those that have been taken hostage. But the way this whole ransom language has been interpreted is like as though it's paid to God or something. I mean, which should tell you something about, and especially in the context of our discussion of Job here. I mean, right, like the Gentiles, their rulers lord it over them, but, you know, and are tyrants, right? There's a, like, whatever is going on here, it shouldn't be that whole idea of a transaction happening. Like, God is holding all, I mean, God is holding everyone hostage until Jesus submits to being killed to placate the desire. I mean, that's just lording it over. That's just repeating the pattern of lording over. Whatever it is he's talking about, he's ransoming it from Satan or from someone who has an illegitimate claim or someone that has taken someone into bondage. And it's paid to the enemy in a certain sense and becomes, and then in the theology of the cross, then that ransom becomes the means by which to undo the power of the one who has taken those in bondage. I mean, I guess that only really works in that substitutionary atonement on the presumption that God is the enemy whose power needs to be undone or something, which I don't think is what the New Testament is talking about.
No, I don't think so. And in fact, if we connect it to Isaiah, the servant sacrifice in Isaiah is the means by which the servant who triumphs transforms the meaning of life. And so we can see then that in Mark, in the passage that follows in Mark 10, 46 to 52, there's a healing of somebody who is blind. And the healing of the blind sort of brings about a transformed world, because it's not only the case that the somebody who's being unable to see is now able to see, but that section finishes in verse 52, by the blind person whose sight is restored, beginning to see again and following Jesus on the way, which is these are two critical means by which discipleship is identified, following and the way. So the larger purpose is to bring about the healing of humanity, and humanity's response is gratitude and dedication and discipleship. Does that make sense in the context of Mark? Yeah.
This idea of ransom, the thought that I'm trying to think that I can't quite formulate is the way ransom here, as Jesus is talking about it, might shed some light on and illuminate the impasse that we were talking about happening in the Job discourse.
Well, if it's possible to take the enslavement of Jesus to Satan in the language of Mark's gospel, because of the interpretation that people have given to the passages earlier in Mark about binding the strong man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Which the strong man, of course, being Satan.
Right.
And this is what Jesus is doing by the actions that proclaim the manifestation of God's presence in the world through the transformation of human life, through exorcisms, through healings, through parables, through transformations of every kind, and all of those function to bind Satan.
Right. Well, and maybe one interesting way of reading that would be if at the end of Job's question still remains and is posed as a question to which perhaps even God has to acknowledge the legitimacy of, maybe. I don't know that we get that exactly, but that it remains unanswered, right? Like Job has put a question to God, which God has said, "Hey, look, man, I do the rain, I do all this stuff. You know, I don't understand why you're raising this question." And then he's like, "You know, I think you do." And God's like, "Okay, And it just kind of ends, right? Like there is a real, and that would make sense of the kind of violence that, like the kind of protest against kind of natural violence and things like that, that we see in the New Testament, and to which then this ransom could then be brought into, like, this is a, we can look at the disclosure of God, of what the God that is revealed fully in the person of Jesus and in the cross and resurrection is a response to that question.
Yep.
Maybe that's how I'd like to think it.
Yes. Yes. I think that's very helpful. And I must say, Josh, I find it helpful to hear you think through your theological responses to these various passages, because they bring out really different aspects that wouldn't naturally occur to me. And what we do together is try to break out of our silos. I don't know right. how else to say that. That's yeah. really what we're trying to do. And if we were, I mean, you and I share a fascination and a commitment to theological education. If we were doing this for people who were going in training for church ministries of different kinds, we would try and emphasize something else altogether. Right now, we don't have to do that because we're not working in a seminary building towards that end. Do you see what I'm talking about? We would put pastoral care front and center.
Right.
We would put training in that discipline front and center. But now what we're doing is trying to reach out of the scriptures towards some kind of theological interpretation, and you're trying to comment on them to
well to make that. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but the way in which we respond to questions like this has everything to do with the way in which we place ourselves when we bring those questions to the scriptures and think through what it is that they reveal. I mean, nothing is probably more harmful pastorally in a context of intense suffering than to provide superficial answers. I mean, that's one of the things that the Job's friends and companions, that's what they demonstrate. Being able to raise this question of suffering to the next level and provide a theological frame within which to think it through is absolutely essential to responsible pastoral care.
And we should remember that they sit with him in silence for 7 days at the beginning.
Right.
That's absolutely crucial to hold in mind.
Absolutely.
They're sitting Shiva. Good. Okay. So should we pause there and look forward to next week's discussion of the ending of the book of Job, assuming the world doesn't cease to exist and that Desmond right. Tutu can go on to his 91st year.
Right. Yes. That's great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, see you next week. Goodbye, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.